Current state, Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. It is Tuesday, July 8th, day one of Lansing's Common Ground Festival. Alt Rockers Brand New is the featured band tonight with around 10 other bands altogether. This is a deal. The Hold Steady, Circa Survive, and Say Anything. Adato Riverfront Park is the place, downtown Lansing. Later this hour on this edition of Current State, a new University of Michigan study suggests your attitudes toward love and romance may be determined by the TV shows and movies that you watch. Or is it the other way around? Are the movies and the TV shows you watch determined? Well, that is one of my questions for Professor Julia Lippman, who joins us in just a little bit. At the top of our program today, fishing in Michigan is big business. The state DNR estimates that anglers spent $2.4 billion in trip-related expenses and equipment in 2011. Besides Michigan's Great Lakes and rivers, our inland lakes attract considerable fishing as well. In fact, six Michigan lakes were recently included in a National Fishing Magazine's 100 Best Bass Lakes of 2014 list. Current State's Melissa Benmark talked bass fishing recently with Dr. Mary Tate Bremigan of MSU's Department of Fisheries and Wildlife.
I'm an aquatic ecologist, and I focus also on applying aquatic ecology to fisheries management. And the two main things that I study are, one is very in-lake oriented. I study the reproductive ecology of largemouth bass and how fishing affects that and largemouth bass populations. And I also study lakes in a much broader context of how landscape features and human alterations to the landscape, I study how that affects water quality and fish assemblages. And I have many highly valued collaborators in those projects.
How are Michigan's largemouth bass doing?
I'd say overall, from what we know, Michigan's largemouth bass and smallmouth bass are doing quite well. I can speak the most to the populations in lakes, but they're also in our rivers and they're in the Great Lakes. A couple things we know, or a couple indicators of their health, would be in, when was that? Over 10 years ago, the Fisheries Division changed the minimum size limit for bass. They increased it from 12 inches, being the smallest size of bass that could be harvested, to 14 inches. And we know from monitoring of lakes that the size structure of bass populations has improved over that time period. And we know they're very popular with anglers in general. We know that, about a quarter of the fishing days in Michigan are directed towards these bass species. And recently, the Bassmasters magazine named, about six Michigan locations as in their top 100 places to bass fish in the nation. And last year, Lake St. Clair was the top of the list, and it's still in the top, somewhere in the top 25. I can't remember the exact number. And that's actually quite a feat, given that these bass species and fish species in general, their growth rate is very dependent on water temperature. So when you think of the southern water bodies in our country, they typically have warmer temperatures. They, so to speak, they have a leg up on producing large bass. So the fact that we have this many really highly valued bass fisheries is a really good sign.
Well, I know a lot of the inland lakes have had, at this point, probably all of them have had issues with, for instance, zebra mussel contamination. Have you seen changes related to that?
Two main points I'd like to make about that. In terms of zebra mussels in particular, it's my colleagues that have demonstrated that, Dr. A. Sarnelli and his lab, for example. And so what they have shown is that if we compare lakes that zebra mussels have invaded to lakes that don't have zebra mussels, it's the relatively low nutrient lakes that appear to be particularly vulnerable to negative effects of zebra mussels on the water quality. And in particular, they've shown that there's a certain type of general type of algae, blue-green algae, which generally are undesirable and which can produce toxins in the water. And those blue-green algae and their toxins generally increase more after zebra mussel invasion in these low-nutrient lakes. And that underlies how complicated it is to really be able to say with confidence, you know, Melissa, here's the health of our inland lakes, because there's so many things about the lakes that we care about: their water quality, the abundance of fish, the size structure of the fish, the genetic integrity of the fish populations, the contaminant loads in the fish, the habitat quality. So there's so many things that we could base that assessment on. And there is so much natural variation among lakes, and we typically lack data from before humans started impacting lakes. So when we're really trying to say, what's our goal for these lakes, how do we balance emphasis on how they used to be, and how do we balance emphasis on how we want them to be now, and how we use them, it becomes incredibly difficult to answer the question. And as a researcher, I focus more on why it's difficult. So it's even harder for me to say, here's how our lakes are. So I think, you know, generally we have amazing aquatic resources in Michigan, but we also know that they are subject to many different anthropogenic stressors. And there's a lot of research going on and a lot of work by, say, the DNR to try to understand that and try to mitigate it.
When we were talking before, when we were setting up this interview, you mentioned some concerns about bass aggressiveness and fishing. And I'm curious if you'd tell our listeners kind of what that's all about.
I would be happy to talk about bass aggression. So largemouth and smallmouth bass, and actually many of their relatives, if you will, a group of species called centrorchids, like bluegill and crappie, they all have a reproductive behavior that involves parental care by the male, which is somewhat out of the ordinary for fish. So in the spring, males gather in the inshore areas of lakes and shallow areas of rivers, and some of these males build nests. You might see sort of an area in a lake shoreline that looks like a bowl has been scooped out, and it looks as though the silt has been moved away, and indeed that has occurred. The male bass, in the case of my research, the male bass constructs this nest. One or more females come and deposit eggs. The female's energy investment is in her calorie-rich eggs. So once her eggs are laid, generally speaking, she leaves. The male invests his energy into reproduction through guarding those offspring. So the eggs, and then the eggs hatch into tiny little larvae a few millimeters long, and they start to grow up into small little fish. And when they're still, say, less than an inch, the male is guarding them and protecting them from predators. And what we generally know is that in the absence of fishing, it's the most aggressive bass that are the best dads. They do the best job of protecting their offspring. But that aggressiveness also makes them more vulnerable to fishing, because our general understanding is that when a fishing lure plops near their nest, their little fishy brain interprets that as a potential nest predator, and they strike at it. And they're captured. So that makes them fun to catch. And so from a management standpoint, we're trying to balance sort of, are we sufficiently protecting these bass populations and the aggressive dads that we know are highly successful in their reproduction? We're trying to balance that with the desires of the anglers to capture bass and enjoy it.
I know that that hunting numbers have gone down in the state, and you know, hunting and fishing always happen in the same sentence. Are younger people fishing at the rates that that our forebears were?
Ah, what a good question. Here's what I can tell you. I can tell you that I've seen data on the fishing license sales every year from 2000 until 2013. And over that 13-year time period, the highest license sales were in 2000, about 1,400,000. In 2013, it was down by a bit over 100,000. There appears over that time period to be somewhat of a trend of declining license sales, but clearly it's not some precipitous fall. The data that I've seen don't allow us to determine whether it's young people or older individuals who are buying those licenses. So I have heard that as a concern, but I can't absolutely validate it. But that's why there are efforts to, you know, reach out to young anglers, to reach out to urban anglers, et cetera, and help them become invested or experience fishing and decide if they'd like to make it a habit.
As someone myself who's a female in an almost completely male, not as much, but when I started out, it was almost completely a male field. And you're working in, I mean, there's a reason everybody says fishermen. You're an expert on you know, one of the state's biggest game fish, and you're a woman. What drew you to this?
What drew it to me was a childhood of enjoying the outdoors and family vacations to the outdoors with a little bit of fishing, but not lots. So I'm a little out of the ordinary in my field in many ways. And one is that I didn't come to this field so much through fishing. Based on my interests, I became a biology and ecology major as an undergrad, and I took a summer field course in Michigan's Upper Peninsula on aquatic ecology, and I loved it. So that sealed me on aquatic ecology, and my first experience was in water quality, and that was in nutrients, and that was very interesting, but it just seemed like, well, gosh, I ought to know about fish, too, and fish seem really cool. So I went into fisheries somewhat naive to the challenges of being a woman in fisheries, and I'm stubborn. And that said, I have to be very careful here. I honestly think it is difficult, and I would love to sit down and talk about that. That said, I also have some phenomenal male colleagues, and life is a balance of those two things. But I can't imagine getting by without my amazingly fabulous female colleagues.
Dr. Mary Tate Bremgen, thank you so much.
You are very welcome. Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. The next time you're listening online, visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/current state. You can always follow us on Twitter, too, if you're not already, at KAR Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Those of us who work in radio have a natural interest in our voices, but lots of people rely on their voices to make a living. A researcher at Michigan State University is looking into the factors that can damage our voices and how to avoid them. Current State Scott Pohl talked with Eric Hunter, an associate professor of communicative sciences and disorders at MSU, about how important the voice is to millions of Americans.
When I think of people who use their voices in their living, I, of course, think of radio announcers, but there's also singers. And yet there's a lot more to it than that. When we've talked briefly before this interview, occupations that I hadn't really considered came up. And primarily among those was teachers. And, of course, it's a natural fit. They talk all day long. They probably have to raise their voices at least some of the time. A lot of the subjects you work with have been teachers.
Yeah, people that use their voice in an occupational setting make up about that's a primary tool of the trade, they're using their voice, is about 25% of the occupational population. Teachers are about three times more likely to be seen in a voice clinic than other people that use their voice as an occupational tool of the trade.
Well, you know, the obvious thing to think about is the amount of time they talk and the volume at which they maybe need to talk. I've seen teachers in some classrooms who wear a microphone and their voices are amplified for their students. What sorts of problems seem to crop up most often with teachers?
Well, they usually start affecting how they use their voice in their classroom, and it usually starts because they can't get the attention of the class anymore. And so they'll have some complaints that they can't have the range of their voice use, they can't be as dynamic as they often are. So those are where the complaints usually start. If they're seen by someone, or if they're not seen by something, then it can grow into something that can be long-term.
Is it something that gets worse over the course of time? I suspect young teachers maybe have an easier time with this than teachers who've been around a long time, that older teachers perhaps experience more problems.
You have two components of that. One is as the voice ages, it doesn't recover as well. And there are a lot of techniques people try to do to help offset aging, which many of them do help. But you also have an experience factor. Some of the young teachers are not very experienced on how well their voice feels and how they need to pace themselves throughout a day and even at the beginning of a school year.
Are there techniques that can help with that?
There are. The techniques that can help with vocal health generally, especially with teachers, can be thought of in two categories. One of them would bring up is called vocal hygiene. So how to just take care of your voice generally, making sure you're healthy, drinking enough water, staying away from irritants, common things like cutting down on smoking, too much caffeine and hot drinks. Now, the other aspect is actually what you do, such as a vocal athlete, any athlete would want to do warm-ups, watching how they use their voice during the day, as any athlete would, and then cool downs at the end.
Not unlike what we see singers do sometimes, warming up before a performance.
Yes, singers, they have to live with it every day, where most of the rest of us that aren't performers of voice, that aren't using it professionally, don't think about it. And so all of a sudden you take someone that's a teacher that isn't a performer, you're thrown into this environment they're using all the time in a performance aspect. They just, you know, they may be able to get by for a while, but it's just a matter of time.
Are there techniques we can learn from, say, actors who have to learn how to project their voices?
Yes. In some education departments around the country, they do have at least a day of how to use your voice in a room, project well. There are also other techniques on what a good warm-up is. Many of them that have problems end up, after getting medical issues resolved, will end up working with a singer or an actor to build their voice, a voice actor.
Now, you brought up the subject of aging earlier, and I think all of us have a handle on the fact that our voices change as we age. Can you explain why that is? Why would my voice sound any different than it did on tapes I made 20 years ago?
The vocal system is made up of a lot of muscles and also has some cartilages that have a joint just as your knee would or your shoulder would. And so anything that will affect other parts of those body that have muscles and joints will also affect the voice. So the cartilages, because it's around cartilage, starts to get hard and isn't as pliable. The joint doesn't move as much. And then the muscles begin to, they call it atrophy, they become less massive, they aren't as weak, and that will change the breathy quality of a voice. So you hear somebody that's elderly, they'll have a breathiness to their voice. They also won't have the range of pitches they used to because they don't have the same movement because of these cartilages.
One thinks of needing rest to get your voice back when you've had an issue, but beyond rest, what other treatments sometimes do people need? Are there medications that help? Surgery sometimes perhaps called for?
It depends on what's wrong. From what most of us will run into on day-to-day life, and even many performers of voice, broadcasters or anything, rest does a lot of good. And it usually takes about two to three days to start getting voice back unless there's been a lot of damage. And then sometimes it's a couple weeks. People that don't depend on their voice, if they have a problem that's persisting more than about 2 weeks, it's time to be seen by a specialist. If you're dependent on it in a performance mode, we usually say if it's longer than a week, you know, it's go get seen. Make sure there's, make sure there's no lumps and bumps. They go in there and they take a peek at them. They make sure there's something that's not abnormal, that isn't just the normal course of recovery.
One of the things I know that you've examined is gender-specific voice accommodation strategies for teachers and people maybe who work in call centers, people who are talking all day long. So talk about how you might approach this issue for male patients as opposed to maybe a different strategy with female patients.
Well, for whatever reason, and we're still investigating it, women just have a higher instance of voice issues. That is more than just occupational hazard or requirements. And because of that, and also the systems, even though they're different. The women use a different range in their voice, and the men do. You can see that in singers and acting performers. So a good clinical voice pathologist will treat the two differently. There are many of the techniques that are similar, but a man might be required to do different kind of warm-up techniques. They also will be given different kind of time course intervention. But women also are a little bit more attuned to changes because of the range they use.
Since you do so much work with teachers, I wonder if that's a factor here, just that more teachers are women. Is that maybe part of this equation?
It is. About in the United States, 80% of grade school teachers are women. So you have teachers which are inherently using their voice a lot, which puts them at a higher risk of an issue. Then you have women that are about twice as likely to have issues over men. And so you have an population of people and a population of individuals who are at a high, we consider them a high risk for voice problems.
One thing I've learned over the years is to not abuse my voice, and things I have done in the past that I don't do anymore. Like, for instance, if I go to a Saturday football game, I'll cheer and so on, but I'm conscious of not yelling too loud. I've had Monday mornings in the past where my voice was still suffering from the football game on Saturday. Talk about short bursts of abusing your voice and the problems that can cause.
Well, a short burst all by itself probably won't do a lot, but it's that prolonged one, like in a football game where you go to the soccer game on Saturday morning of a nephew or a niece or a sibling or a son or a daughter. You go to those things and you produce a loud voice for more than just calling across the street to a friend or a neighbor. That will add up very quickly and do damage. And the damage that's done is similar to clapping your hands. If you clapped your hands a couple of times at a concert is one thing, but if you go to, once again, you go to a sporting event, you clap the whole time, your hand starts, you start feeling it. You're doing some damage there, damage that can be, that will your body will recover from, but it's still damage.
Are there times where the sound of someone's voice is an indicator of a physical problem that otherwise you might not know about? I ask because of the approach I see in some TV commercials for dentists, that when you see your dentist might see something while examining your mouth and your teeth and gums that indicates another problem that you need to see a doctor about. Does that ever happen with people when you hear their voice? Is there something that you can hear sometimes that indicates another problem?
Your voice, the creation of voice right at the neck area is right at the lifeline of everything that happens in our bodies. Everything kind of constricts and goes through there. So it's very susceptible to issues that we have in other places. It's susceptible to whether we're having breathing issues, neurological issues. And so an early indication of Parkinson's disease, if people were aware of it, is a weakening voice. And they may not notice in other ways because that's where it hits. So there are ways. In fact, in the old days, doctors, before they could do all the diagnostics they do, they'd talk to somebody, they'd listen to their voice, they'd smell their breath. There are things they could indicate, yeah, there's something going on here that's more than meets the eye.
When do you think, as a patient, I should consider seeking help if I think I'm having a problem with my voice for a few days or something like that? When is it time to go see a doctor?
Well, we all get that way, whether it's from yelling at a game or because we get sick and we lose our voice from a little bit. But if it persists after the original reason happened, and our general rule of thumb that we kick around in the vocal health community is about 2 weeks. If you're just a regular person that's not dependent on your voice and you have these hoarse symptoms and your voice is really having a hard time but not getting better after 2 weeks, it's time to be seen.
Eric Hunter is an associate professor in the Department of Communicative Sciences and Disorders at Michigan State University. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl. We'll be right back.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR, Lansing Board of Water and Light GM Peter Lark is expected to go before BWL commissioners today and request a 7% hike in electricity rates that would take effect on November the 1st. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us here on Tuesday. Much of Michigan is enjoying a very green summer thanks to abundant rain the past few months. Today, WKAR's Peter Wharf continues his focus on plants, this time plants native to Michigan. Peter recently spoke with MSU grad Bill Schneider, owner of Wild Type Native Plant Nursery in Mason. The two discuss plants native to our state, Bill's water conservation projects, and take a quick tour of the greenhouses.
What I think is interesting and maybe a little unfortunate is that our customers are only using a small percentage routinely of the plants we grow. So the majority of our plants that are sold make up a very small percentage of the species we offer.
What are some in that smaller, more popular group, the types that people buy mostly?
Well, in terms of prairie species, they're butterfly weed and some of the prairie grasses and other prairie wildflowers. In terms of shrubs, we sell a lot of shrub dogwoods and shrubs like nannyberry, oaks as it relates to trees, species along those lines.
Right, right. What are some of the more fun and unusual things, like the ones that you just mentioned?
Well, the more obscure species that we grow that are not as sought after as I would hope would be species like spikenard or death camas. It's hard to sell a plant that has a name like death camas.
Why is it beneficial to grow native plants, say, in a suburban garden or an in-town garden?
Well, there are many reasons. I think one of the most popularized and notable reasons is that they support pollinators and beneficial insects in places where there isn't a lot of flora to support them. And they also are supportive of the charismatic insects and animals we like to see. They support butterflies and hummingbirds and a variety of other animals. So if you want those kinds of things as part of your environment, and you should, even if you live in a highly urbanized area, you can bring them in and support them with native flora.
Right. I had a rare hummingbird sighting in my front yard about a week ago. What are some of the things that attract hummingbirds, that attract butterflies? Because I know I want those things.
Sure. There's a certain specific group of plants that attract hummingbirds, things like cardinal flower and columbine and a host of other very specific plants. As it relates to butterflies, the adult butterflies nectar on a variety of flowering plants. If you put a lot of flowering plants in your yard, native or non-native, you'll attract a lot of butterflies. Mm-hmm. But among our, what I would call sophisticated customers, is they're looking for the larval host. So if you want a specific butterfly, you have to have the plant where the immature part of that life cycle is supported, and that's the larva or the caterpillar.
Yeah.
They come here with a long list. They want to support mourning cloaks or American painted ladies or a whole variety of butterflies, of course including monarchs. Yeah. And each one has a specific larval host plant. Yeah. Or set of plants.
We've explored a few of the ideas about the plants that you have here. Talk to me about some of the specific other projects that you've been involved in, water conservation and those sorts of things.
A lot of interest in native flora has been focused on stormwater management. This is the invisible part of our built landscape. Very few people pay much attention to managing stormwater, but it's a very big and expensive part of suburbia and urbanized areas, as well in rural areas. So if you're going to create places to hold stormwater, those places have to have vegetation that can support periodic inundation. So we've worked on what are termed rain gardens all over the state, stormwater treatment projects all over. from drain commissioner projects to projects that involve shopping centers and apartment buildings, condominiums.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm talking with Bill Schneider in Mason, Michigan, graduate of Michigan State University. Where do you gather your seed?
We collect our seed from wild populations across the state. And we document those sources. The places we collect these plants is mostly private property, but some public land by permission. And we do this so that we maintain the genetic diversity found within the population. We're trying not to impose much selection on the plants we produce so that they have enough variability, genetic variability, to create and support sustainable populations.
Let's have a look then at where you're growing.
Sure.
Let's go. Okay, well, we've just left the front of the house, so to speak. Where are we now?
We're in the germ house. I'm going to turn the fans off. This space makes me happy. We germinate thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of seedlings at any given time here in this house. We've collected the seed in the summer and fall of the year before. We've treated the seed by putting it through a cold period so it is prepared to germinate when we put it into a warm environment. And what we're looking at here are hundreds of germination trays. Each tray has 512 cells, and we sow these trays in hopes that we get good germination.
And is this sort of black plastic flats like you would see at a garden store, but they're very small cells, almost like a honeycomb?
Very small, 512 cells in about a foot and a quarter square feet. So you can tell that they're very, very small. Mm-hmm. And then we germinate them. Sometimes we're very successful. Sometimes we are completely unsuccessful.
Really?
It's a lot of unpredictability.
Why is that?
Well, it could be that we had poor germination due to the quality of the seed we collected was not great. It could be that we could have had some fungal problems that destroyed the seedlings as they germinated. Maybe it wasn't, the seed didn't receive a long enough cold period in order to break the dormancy that's necessary. It's for a myriad of reasons, and we sometimes think we know why things don't germinate well, and sometimes we think we know why they do germinate well, and then you do it the next time just the same way and you get a different result. So we're continually humbled by this process because we're not always successful, and we can't always predict how things are going to turn out.
Bill Schneider at Wild Type in Mason, Michigan. Thanks again.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
Keep in mind that Congressman Gary Peters is among our guests tomorrow here on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. Love, is it destiny? Something that conquers all or something that requires work and compromise? Chances are your answer may be related to what kinds of TV shows and movies you like to watch. That's according to a new study. A group of University of Michigan researchers recently published a paper that examines the connection between romantic media and real-life perceptions of love and romance. Joining us now to talk about the study is its lead author, Julia Lippman. Julia is a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Michigan's Department of Psychology. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you for having me.
So give us the framework of your study here. What did you do exactly?
Sure. Well, the short version of what we were interested in investigating was links between people's exposure to romantic media genres and their endorsement of different types of idealistic romantic beliefs. And by romantic beliefs, I mean things like the idea that everyone has one true love, or the belief that love can overcome all obstacles, no matter how big. And what we found was that there was a link between romantic media exposure and romantic beliefs, and that the types of romantic beliefs that people endorsed were consistent with the types of messages that are promoted by these genres.
Did you have a particular hypothesis going into this thing? Were you inclined to think that there was a determining factor there?
Yeah, so I mean, we did suspect, based on previous research, that there would be a link between the sorts of media that people were watching and the types of beliefs they would hold. One of the things that we did that was a bit different, though, than some of the previous research was to break out different types of romantic media. So not just looking at all romantic media exposures together, but breaking out, okay, what happens when you watch romantic-themed movies? What happens when you watch sitcoms? What happens when you watch these sort of marriage-themed reality shows like The Bachelor? And so we did expect most of what we found to come out the way it did, but that was the new angle we were taking with this study.
Who did you target to participate in the study?
So this was a sample of undergraduate students, which is a great time to study this sort of thing because these are people who are at an age when they're really forming ideas about relationships because they typically have fairly limited experience themselves. So they're still more likely to be affected by the types of messages that they're exposed to in the media.
Mm-hmm. Were there any talk about the differences between how the females and the males responded? Or did you look at that in your study?
We did look at that. And we did control for in our analyses, but there weren't really huge differences. The one main difference we did see, yeah, in terms of the relationship, there wasn't. I mean, what we did see was that women tended to consume more of these media genres and that men actually, somewhat counterintuitively, although this is consistent with previous research, men actually endorse higher levels of these sort of idealistic romantic beliefs. But when you look at them all together and you control for the effects that their sex might have on the relationship, it comes out pretty much the same.
So clarify for us. I mean, you looked at this, the media came first and the attitude second. I mean, it must have crossed your mind that in some cases the attitude comes first and that people select their media based on the attitude they already had. Did you give that any thought?
Absolutely. And that's a great point. I think it's going to be helpful to think of the research process as a puzzle. And so you start with an idea. So in this case, we had the idea that maybe romantic media is causing romantic beliefs. And that's the full puzzle. So then what you're doing in research is trying to add pieces to the puzzle one at a time that are consistent with that idea. Like, for example, do they correlate? Does the media content that they're interested in contain messages that one might expect would lead to these beliefs? Is there some theory that could explain why that causal path might be in place? Hmm. Can you rule out alternative hypotheses? And so what we did in the study was add a piece of the puzzle, but we didn't solve the puzzle. And so certainly, another possibility is that the relationship works the other way, or that it works both ways, that people's media, that their romantic beliefs are shaped by the media they watch, but also that what media they watch is shaped by their romantic beliefs.
Julia Lippman is our guest here on Current State. Julia is a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Michigan's Department of Psychology, and she recently headed a study that examined the connection between romantic media and real-life perceptions of love and romance. What kind of TV shows and movies did you use in the study?
So the list of shows that participants were given were shows that were popular at the time. So sitcoms, they were things like How I Met Your Mother or The Big Bang Theory. For the reality shows, it was things like The Bachelor, The Bachelorette, because we really wanted to focus on these sort of these marriage-themed shows in particular, so that was a smaller universe. But they were all shows that were, sort of the top-rated shows at the time that the survey was administered.
What surprised you in your findings?
I would say that one thing that surprised me was the extent to which it came out the way you would sort of expect it to. It was actually a pretty clean story. So if you think, for example, about what do we see in romantic themed movies? Well, we see that, there's some sort of obstacle, and then ultimately the couple gets together and their love sort of powers them through. And so in theory, that sort of exposure to that sort of message should lead you to more strongly endorse this idea of that love will always find a way. And it did. Or it was correlated with that, I should say. You know, and similarly, marriage sim reality shows, what's big there? Well, people fall in love almost immediately, and they see these partners as almost perfect. You know, and again, that was correlating with these sorts of beliefs here. So I would say the fact that it actually sort of came out pretty much as you would expect, exactly, based on sort of messages, was actually surprising, because you don't get that often in research.
I've always been intrigued by this notion of audience involvement in the performing arts in general. I mean, don't they typically involve some degree of projection here? You've got the audience projecting themselves into what they're viewing. What was that dynamic relevant to your study?
So, I mean, that definitely is relevant to how people are affected by media generally. It's not something we examined in this study. But one related construct we did look at in this study was the idea of perceived realism. So this is the idea that you believe that TV generally portrays the world the way it really is. And that has been shown to be in previous research and was in this study a pretty powerful predictor of the sorts of beliefs that people held. So people who saw TV as more romantic also endorse higher levels of these sorts of romantic beliefs.
This whole idea of projection has always intrigued me, though. I would imagine that varies a lot from genre to genre, though. It would seem you're less apt to project yourself into some crazy sci-fi scenario than into a contemporary romantic comedy.
You'd be surprised the sorts of shows people find something to latch on to. But, you know, certainly, I mean, I think the romantic theme movies they more explicitly are trying to elicit that sort of response. But, you know, certainly people also report being really engaged with and sort of projected into, you know, these more fantasy worlds that aren't necessarily all that realistic.
Mm.
Power of media.
Out of the variety of genres here that you had to choose from, what drew you to this study of romance exactly?
Well, so my research more broadly does look at how media shapes our beliefs and expectations around relationships and sexuality. So this is a topic that's of interest to me and also the colleagues I collaborated with on this paper. And I think it's an important issue because it's so central to our lives. For most of us, relationships are a really important part of what's important to us. And, you know, and research shows that they're really a key contributor to our well-being. So it seems like a really important issue to learn more about.
It seems like a fun thing to study. If you can kind of combine the notion of serious research and something that is just really fun, it seems like this might have that capacity. Was it that way?
I have days where I'm hitting my head against the wall a little bit, but in general, yes, I feel very lucky to be doing what I'm doing.
What's next with this research?
Well, I think, you know, one thing, as you alluded to earlier, is that we really don't know what sort of causal path is in place here, right? So it could be, as you said earlier, that people's romantic beliefs are what is drawing them to these media texts in the first place. And so a great way to sort of get at some of that would be to do a study with longitudinal design, where we could examine the sorts of changes that are occurring over time. So is your media exposure at time two predicting the sorts of romantic beliefs you hold at time two? Or are the romantic beliefs you hold at time one predicting the sort of media you consume at time two, or both?
Mm.
So that's where I would like to take this next.
Julia Lippman has been our guest from the University of Michigan Department of Psychology. She recently wrapped up a study that looked at the connection between romantic media and real-life perceptions of love and romance. Julia, thank you and good luck.
Thank you.
A couple of months ago, current state Scott Pohl visited the president of the Michigan Historical Commission, Jack Dempsey, in Detroit's Capitol Park to discuss his book on the park's historical significance. We like the results so much that we've sent Scott back to Detroit, where Dempsey showed Scott a few more historical spots. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Mark. That's right. Over the coming weeks, we'll bring you several talks with Jack Dempsey from interesting places in Michigan history. For today's conversation, we visited the site of Michigan's original state fairgrounds. If you thought the Michigan State Fair was always at Woodward and 8 Mile, you'd be wrong. But you wouldn't know that by going to the corner of Willis and Cass in the city of Detroit today. In fact, you wouldn't know the site's important military history, or for a time, how it was known as a safe place for women to go horseback riding.
It's hard to tell that that's the case here because we are in the middle of urban Detroit. Cass Avenue, of course, being named for Lewis Cass, a famous figure in Michigan politics, government, and history. But between Woodward and Cass Avenues, and from Alexandrine on the south to Canfield on the north, where today we have a lot of different kinds of buildings, older, newer, some derelict, some in great shape. This is where the state fairgrounds existed long before they were moved out to 8 Mile and Woodward.
What can you tell me about the state fair in those days, and why did the state fair wind up moving around?
The state fair in those days was predominantly agricultural. People brought their produce, their livestock to exhibit, to demonstrate how Michigan could produce such bounty. And it got moved around because of competing needs and interests. For one reason, this was the site also of the Ladies Riding Park. And my understanding is that's where women could come out and ride horses without having to encounter misbehavior by, let's say, the riffraff, the male sect who were trying to impress them. So it was a rather bucolic area and a good site for the fairgrounds, just like when it was moved out to 8 Mile. It was an area that wasn't developed, and so a good site for people to demonstrate Michigan's agricultural prowess.
Let's tidy up the business of the state fairgrounds then. The modern day state fairgrounds, what's become of it? What's its future hold?
It was made part of the state land bank authority. There was a request for proposals, and a development team led by Magic Johnson was awarded that bid. My understanding is there's still negotiations going on to actually bring that to fruition. In the meantime, since 2009, the fairgrounds has been off limits, locked up with little or no access, and we have not had the state fair like we used to prior to 2009.
Now, you told me that this part of Detroit, where we're standing, was also instrumental to the staging of military forces. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, because it was an open area, and it seemed to be a very good rendezvous point for soldiers who were being organized and mustered into service for the Union in the Civil War. Fort Wayne was a mustering point, but it got so crowded they had to find another location. So the old state fairgrounds here became the site where the 24th Michigan Infantry rendezvoused. They named it Camp Barnes after Henry Barnes, who was the publisher of one of the Detroit newspapers. And why would they do that? Well, there was an attempt to raise some troops down in Detroit, and those hostile to the war kind of caused a riot. It became such an embarrassment that the city leaders, including Mr. Barnes, who was the publisher or editor of one of the papers, held a rally a day or so later and tried to restore civic pride in this raising this regiment. And so when the soldiers got here, one of the things they did is name this Camp Barnes in honor of Henry Barnes, who helped raise their regiment. And I believe his younger brother was one of the officers in that regiment. The regiment then that was raised here was the 24th Regiment, known as the Detroit and Wayne County Regiment, colloquially. And 1,000 men strong, raised in August of 1862, mustered in, went to the Eastern Theater, and their most famous moment was at the Battle of Gettysburg on the first day. They went into action very early, had 399 soldiers in their complement at that point. The next day, only 99 reported for duty. The rest were killed, captured, wounded, missing. And they were part of one of the most famous units in Civil War history, the Iron Brigade, five regiments from the Midwest. And the 24th Michigan was a key component of that very famous elite force.
And they also represented Michigan at President Lincoln's funeral.
Correct. They were one of the honor guard constituents that went to Springfield when President Lincoln's coffin was brought there for internment after his assassination. So the regiment has a very amazing history, a storied past, and probably among all the Michigan Civil War units, it would be the most well known. There is a marker in Campus Martius Park in downtown Detroit, as well as out, I believe, at the I-94 rest area in New Buffalo. So at both ends, so to speak, of US 12, where it begins in Detroit and ends at the Indiana-Michigan border, there is a sign that designates that this is in commemoration of the 24th Michigan and the Iron Brigade.
It's interesting that you should bring up the notion of historical markers, because in the walking around we've done in this part of Detroit, we haven't seen any markers for some of this history you're telling me about.
Obviously, if we had a marker, we could focus our attention, but the lack of one requires us to really try to piece together information using the web and other sources. One of my sources is a book written by one of the members of the regiment, O.B. Curtis, after the war. And historical markers, the state historical marker program, is very important to remind us of our past and focus our attention on sites that, from looking at it today, you'd never imagine that this was the state fairgrounds. This is a place where women were able to ride their horses and have recreation, or where this great Civil War unit trained and went off to war from this very ground. So again, it's another indication that historical markers, which continue to be erected, proposed, and installed, are very important to our history.
What's the process for getting markers made?
There is an application online that you can get from the Michigan Historical Commission. You fill that out, you propose why a site is historic, or a person, or a story, and that goes to us. We review it. If we think it's meritorious, we approve the application, and then it goes through a process of research, writing the text, and ultimately having a ceremony to install the marker.
Do you know if that's in the process for this part of Detroit?
I don't believe it is. I've not heard anything that would suggest there is, but we have a number of businesses here, and Wayne State University, and others in the community who perhaps would think this would be a meritorious activity to raise the money and go through that process, which used to be rather cumbersome. Right now it's very easy. We've made it quite easy for people to make that application and go through the process.
So here we are on the radio to encourage that.
I really appreciate the opportunity, because history is so important to us, our way of life, our quality of life. Without our culture and our past, who are we? Where are we going? And we can learn from the past, and we can use it to inspire us in the future.
Well, Jack Dempsey of the Michigan Historical Commission, thank you for another visit to Historic Detroit.
Thank you very much, Scott.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll talk with Congressman and Democratic Senate candidate Gary Peters. We'll also speak with the new Michigan State University provost. Here, June Hewitt is a familiar name to many of you. We'll also visit the Lansing Electronics Extravaganza. Also, a reminder that this Friday, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mark Schauer will be in this studio, Studio S here at WKAR, and the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta will be interviewing the candidate and taking questions from listeners all across the Michigan Public Radio Network. That's our program for today. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. The producer of Current State is Joe Lindstroth. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering. Thanks as well to Melissa Benmark, Kevin Lavery, Scott Pohl. You've been listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR.